Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a journalist and writer who spent most of his 20s as an environmental activist, working with groups like Plain Stupid. He was arrested after protesting a plan to shut down a coal-fired power station and once walked for 8 months, that's 247 days, from England to Istanbul. A visit to Alaska to investigate the human impacts of resource extraction and climate change made him aware of the plight of the king salmon, and he subsequently went on the 2,000-mile canoe trip along the Yukon River to investigate the decline of the fish and the communities that depend on them. The resulting book, The Kings of the Yukon, An Alaskan River Journey, won the Sunday Times Young Writer Award. Adam Weymouth, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's such a pleasure to see you because the last time I saw you, you had just been given this award. And I wonder how you've come to terms with that, because it really is a spectacular prize to set a young writer up for the rest of his career.
Yeah, it felt quite overwhelming, and I think it still does, particularly looking at that list of alumni that have won it before and people that have been so inspirational to me. When we spoke before, I was talking about William Fiennes, who wrote The Snow Geese, that was a big part of the thinking that sort of went into this book, and people like Zadie Smith, Naomi Alderman that have won it as well. And because it's been Christmas, I've sort of just had that time to kind of retreat back into that bubble, and it's felt like a wonderful way to end what was quite an amazing year.
So the prize itself is a partnership between many organisations. The Sunday Times, of course, the newspaper, which really gets behind it with publicity and all the rest of it. The University of Warwick, the literary agency, Peters Fraser Dunlop, and they would then go on to help any winner, I imagine, and the British Council, which really puts you on a global path, the British Council supporting you then to go and talk and write in many different places.
Yeah, it feels really exciting in a sense of doors beginning to open as well, I think. Having this experience, because I started off as a freelance journalist, and there's very much that feeling of banging against doors, being asked to let in for a long, long time and doing a lot of work for free and trying to meet people. And the first few years is really quite a slog, and I'm sure it still will be. And obviously, there's a huge amount of hard work to come. But suddenly having access to places like Warwick and to the British Council feels tremendously exciting, having looked at those places from afar for so long.
Mm. Now, of course, journalism wasn't your first focus. You were very much interested in the environment and obviously still are. Tell me how that came about. Was it a family thing?
I guess you can trace these things back really far, yeah. I mean, I can say it's a family thing in that I remember burying jam jars in the garden with my dad, and we'd look at the little bugs that got caught in there, and all our family holidays were walking holidays in Cornwall and Devon and places like that. Although I remember kind of hating being dragged out walking the cliffs when I was five, but I think something must have stuck. My dad taught me the names of all the birds in the garden, little things like that, but things that, and just having had a baby myself, feel really important to sort of sow those seeds, because you don't really know where they'll go. And then the other love was writing from a very early age. I loved reading. I always thought that I'd probably write fiction, but from a very early age, I enjoyed the writing as well. And at some point along the way, putting those two things together seemed to make sense.
Tell us about your environmental activism days, because they got quite hairy at times.
Yeah, I don't know if they're totally over. Depends if I want to go back to America and be allowed another visa. But I'd always been on the climate change marches in London and every year since being quite young. But it was really moving to Scotland, to Glasgow, and meeting people that were involved in Plain Stupid that I came to believe more in direct action and maybe more confrontational, provocative ways of protesting, which I still completely believe in. I was arrested first for doing a banner drop on the Holyrood, on the Scottish Parliament. And then, as you mentioned, this conspiracy to commit aggravated trespass at Ratcliffe-on-Soar. And also many years going to all the UN conferences in Poland, in Copenhagen, worked on a climate change film called The Age of Stupid. So a lot of my 20s was very much sort of embroiled in that world.
And in terms of the arrest and everything that happened subsequently, was that a painful experience?
It was a very draining experience, yeah. At the time, obviously, we've seen with the three guys that were arrested for the fracking in the Stansted 15, a lot of those sentences which are now being handed out are becoming much more severe than they used to be. When we were on trial for this conspiracy, we were only ever really looking at maybe a few hours community service or something. But the drain of it was the sort of 2 years that we were constantly called back for police interviews and making trips to Nottingham where we were arrested, and just having that hanging over you for such a long period, which really curtails a lot of the things you can do with bail conditions. A lot of people in that court case, I think, were very drained by it. And I suppose it was a mix of the huge kind of personal sacrifice that had been for me, and also the fact that despite putting all that time and energy in, we were still unanimously found guilty, that made me think that maybe, at least from my perspective, there might be better ways of going about things.
And what happened about the actual issue that you were protesting against?
Well, we did actually eventually get let off an appeal. It was around the time that the undercover policeman Mark Kennedy was exposed, and Mark had been one of the original 114 arrestees on this court case. And because certain evidence wasn't released to the defence by the prosecution involving Mark, we were asked to appeal because our conviction was unsound and we were let off.
Mm. And of course, at this time you were writing too.
Around the same time, yes. So I ended up doing this walk to Istanbul for 8 months between being arrested and sitting trial, really because I'd been planning it for years and the court case had been going on for so long that I didn't know when we were ever going to come to sit trial. And I went on the walk, and it was on that walk that I wrote the first few pieces, just kind of short articles for small magazines about what it was like to be walking from London to Paris or walking across the Balkans. And, you know, they got published, I got given 50 quid, and it suddenly seemed that maybe I might be able to make a bit of money from doing something that I loved doing anyway.
Well, tell me about that walk. Why do it?
Why do it? I think, you know, going back to what I said, I'd always had this love of walking foisted upon me by my parents. And then I'd done a few smaller walks. I did the Camino de Santiago one summer at university because a friend had done it and loved it. I'd written a lot about pilgrimage when I did my master's, and I became very interested in these kind of long protest walks, sort of the Gandhi Salt March is the classic one, but these reasons for people doing long walks as a cause for something. And although this walk to Istanbul of mine was not a pilgrimage and was not protesting anything, I was just interested in what might happen if I went on a really long walk. I've been reading so much about it in the library that I thought maybe I should get out and see what it actually felt like to go on such a long walk. I'm very inspired by people like Laurie Lee and Patrick Lee Fermor and beautiful books that about walking in Europe. And it was incredible. It was an amazing time. It felt very much for me. I never had the intention of writing a book about it, but I did a lot of writing for myself every night. And just that sense of connecting Europe somehow. I left from my front door and I stopped in Istanbul, and what it means to walk across these borders and the remarkable hospitality that I was shown along the way from everyone from England to Bulgaria, from Christians to Muslims, people inviting me to stay in churches and mosques, and just a real commonality I felt crossing Europe.
Mm. And you also walked across Scotland.
Yeah, so a few years later I got interested in this way of maybe kind of joining dots, partly from going to a Richard Long exhibition first, actually, who sort of has done great walks kind of connecting the first Stone Age tool to the birth of the Industrial Revolution. And I put together a walk across Scotland. There's this growing call at the moment for wolves to be reintroduced to Scotland. And so I did a walk that started at a place called Allerdale, where Paul Lister's trying to bring back wolves, and finished at the legendary site where the last wolf in Scotland was meant to have been killed. So it was a walk across Scotland, and the idea was to talk to people on the ground about how they'd feel about wolves coming back. I was reading all this scientific literature and polemic about why we should or shouldn't have wolves, but I felt very few people were talking to the sheep farmers and the gamekeepers and the hikers about what it might be like to have wolves back in Scotland.
Mm. And that really is the key to it all, isn't it? It's about talking to the people that you meet along the way. It's the human interaction with the environment.
Yeah, so I feel that these doing these long overland journeys, like in Kings of the Yukon as well, it's a way of, rather than picking your research places before you go, which is quite a standard journalist way of working, you go in, you get your soundbite, and then you leave again. This way of travelling overland slowly, you get a kind of real cross-section of people and place, and everything's a kind of chain of coincidence. You meet someone who tells you to go and stay with their friend in the next village, and you just kind of get passed from place to place. And there's a way of researching in what feels like quite an unbiased way, and a way that people seem to connect to. You know, you've put in the time, you know the area a bit better. People open up to it, I think.
So why Alaska? Why the Yukon?
Well, I suppose I'd always been drawn to Alaska in the way that a lot of people are drawn to Alaska. I remember seeing White Fang in the cinema when I was about 6 years old, and David Attenborough documentaries, and reading Farley Moat, and just this One thing that I felt walking across Europe, you know, it's beautiful and there's mountain ranges, and but you're never that remote. You're never more than half a day's walk away from a village. And I was drawn into this idea of these sort of vast, untamed spaces, which I've since come to learn is, you know, a bit of a projection and a fantasy as well. But that's probably what drew me into Alaska in the first place, coupled with my growing interest as an environmental journalist and finding just this place of vast contradictions, someone that's heating twice as fast as the rest of the planet is heating, but is also totally dependent upon its oil wealth. Villages which are severely impacted by climate change right now, but also a very right-wing environment that denies climate change. And it seemed like an interesting place to go and look at those human stories behind the climate change.
Mm, because before you made the journey for the book, you'd actually visited Alaska previously.
Exactly. Yeah, I was given a travel fellowship from the Winston Churchill Foundation and went there as an environmental journalist, really. So that first trip that was over about 3 months, I travelled all over Alaska to whaling communities and the site of the Exxon Valdez spill and a town where all the gold panners from all across America go and celebrate 4th of July, just looking at all these different aspects of resource use and climate change and also just kind of scratching that itch that I'd had about Alaska for so long. Mm. And it was through those travels that I came across this story of the plight of the king salmon, which I wrote an article about, and that ended up growing into the book.
What is the plight of the king salmon?
So when I was there on the first trip, I came across this one town called Bethel, and these 23 Yupik fishermen were on trial for catching king salmon when there was a ban placed on them. And the Alaska Department of Fish and Game had put a ban on them because the numbers had crashed massively in recent years. There's 5 species of salmon in Alaska, but it's the kings that were being hit the hardest and also the most important for indigenous people. But the indigenous people had gone out and fished anyway because they said it was part of their cultural heritage and that's how they're defending themselves, the right to practice their religion. And so it seemed to me that these two different ways of understanding the world were being forced up against each other. How do we choose what we try and conserve? And so I wrote an article and then I followed the story from afar. And the next year, the fishing of king salmon was banned along the entire length of the Yukon River, 2,000 miles. Salmon numbers had gone down to about a tenth of what they were historically, about 300,000 fish down to 30,000. And then that ban was enacted again the next year. And it seems that there's wider story growing here. And I'd had this real sense in Alaska that when you talk to people about salmon, it's about so much more than that. It's not just about the fish, but it's about these indigenous ways of life.
Mm, as we find out through reading the book. So you decide to go there and you decide to do the length of the Yukon, 2,000 kilometres by canoe. Now, you weren't a canoeist.
Not at all. Not at all. I wrote the proposal and was very excited to sell the book. And it was only sitting in a meeting with my publisher just after selling it that she said to me, "So how much canoe experience have you got?" And I said I'd spent about an afternoon in a canoe up to that point and started to get a bit of a sense of what I'd let myself into.
A brave thing to do, as we discover on your journey.
That's one way of saying it.
Give us an idea then of the environment and the geography, because I, like many uneducated people, I guess, think of Alaska as kind of flat and white. There's so much more to it.
Mm, and I wouldn't say uneducated. I mean, it's a very hard region to go to, apart from certain bits of it. It's very untraveled. There's very few people know about it. It changes hugely. So we started the trip at the furthest point where the king salmon reached on their migration. The furthest ones will travel almost 2,000 miles upriver to this little mountain lake called McNeil Lake. So we caught a float plane up there and started there, these beautiful sort of glacial melt rivers tumbling down through the mountains. And then as it progresses, it really widens out to still going through this beautiful mountainous scenery, which gradually changes as you get closer to the sea. And the Yukon becomes huge. So at the point where it actually reaches the sea, it's 7 miles from bank to bank. But it wouldn't be uncommon to be paddling on a river, even 1,000 miles from the sea, that was maybe 2 miles across. So it's an absolutely vast body of water. And for the most part, incredibly isolated. So for about the last 1,000 miles, there's no road system there. Every single village, and you might come to a village every 100 miles or so, or just these little isolated cabins inhabited by some misanthrope who's decided to drop out of life. You can only get into them by boat or by bush plane, so very remote areas that travellers don't really get to at all.
Mm. You weren't completely on your own. You were accompanied by your partner.
Mm. The first part of the journey, I was with an old Scottish guy called Hector, who's been a guide out there forever, and I had some part of the journey by myself, and then for the last 2 months or so my girlfriend came out to join me. She grew up in the north of Sweden, right on the Arctic Circle. So in some ways, it was a much more familiar environment to her than it was to me.
Yeah. That's got to be a relationship changer, though, hasn't it?
Well, we came back and we had a kid. So it worked. But yeah, it's intense, definitely. I mean, you know, for maybe a week at a time, we'd see no one apart from us. And you're in an 18-foot canoe in the middle of absolute nowhere. And we really sort of built a dependency on each other. And most of my trips up till then, the walk across Scotland, the walk across Europe, all my other travelling has always been by myself. So it was a big learning process to do something with someone else as well.
A dependency on each other and also on the community that you meet on the way. And the history of the people and the fish are so intertwined. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so you really realise... You know, one of the benefits of researching this trip was that people would invite us in to eat salmon with them all the time. People are still fishing a little bit and they really want to share. That's the kind of hospitality there. And you'd realise talking to people over these meals that you talk to people about salmon and people talk about so much more than that. They talk about their hope for their children's futures or what it means to try and live subsistence in capitalist 21st century America, what it means to be indigenous but also North American, why they choose to live where they do in these incredibly remote places. It was the salmon was this kind of lens onto this much wider lifestyle, which in some ways is very 21st century, and everyone communicates on Facebook now and about where the good fishing is, but in some ways is also a way of life that hasn't changed for many thousands of years.
And these were mostly First Nation people that you were speaking to. And in fact, at the beginning of the book, you explain the terminology and how perhaps the word Indian, in fact, came from an entirely different root from the one we suppose.
Yeah, so, and this was brought to me by Howard Jacobson, who wrote the foreword to the Canadian edition, who suggests that Columbus called Indians Indians because it comes from Indios, meaning with God in Spanish. And whether or not that is factually, etymologically accurate, it's an interesting way to kind of flip that, what's in the past has been quite a derogatory term, on its head. Alaskans will refer to themselves as Indians and Eskimos rather than First Nations or Native Americans because they are two genetically very distinct people. The people that call themselves Eskimos have genetic heritage with people from Greenland and Siberia, whereas people that call themselves Indians have genetic heritage with other Native American groups from the rest of North America. So as a way of making that distinction, there isn't really another adequate way of saying it.
And of course, these two separate groups of people who haven't met, probably never will meet, are intimately linked because of the river.
Exactly. Historically, they were very much at war and they would meet at this kind of no man's land to trade goods. But apart from that, they were very scared of the other group of people. Increasingly, there have been programs to try and take people from the source of the river down to the mouth and vice versa. Because yes, although they're intimately connected in one way, they're also 2,000 miles apart, the distance from London to Athens. And it's very easy to suppose that the reasons for the decline of the salmon is everything that's happening at the other end of the river. One Canadian said to me, the Canadians shit in our water, so we're going to take their fish. It's very much a sort of back and forward of...
But also very difficult when trying to plan for the future and how fishing is regulated, because one group may say, on a voluntary basis, we're not going to fish. But if somebody further downstream isn't doing that, it becomes very problematic.
Yeah, the bureaucracy is one huge part of it, because obviously the salmon have no awareness or care for borders. But the Yukon bridges Canada and Alaska, and the amount of salmon that America is supposed to allow through to Canada and the amount of salmon that Canada is supposed to allow back to Alaska, that the First Nations govern themselves in totally different ways in Canada and Alaska. So as much as it's an ecological disaster at the moment, it's also just a bureaucratic nightmare.
You use the story of people's livelihoods really as a tool to talk about the state of the natural environment. And we really get to know some of the people that you meet along the way, some absolutely extraordinary characters. Tell us a little bit about Mary.
Everyone loves Mary. we both absolutely fell in love with Mary. And I suppose it's that thing of the people, this original idea that I had that Alaska was this sort of vast wilderness and you can go and be whoever you want there. You realise even though it's incredibly sparsely populated, the people are so much part of the place, and the histories of the people and the history of settling there is so wrapped up in the environment and the ecology. Mary has a life that almost seems to span the history of Alaska. Well, what's interesting about the North is it's been so, that rate of change has been so accelerated. So rather than the rest of the lower 48 states that have been changing since Columbus got there in 1492 or even earlier, no one had really seen a white man in Alaska until the gold rush in 1896. And so you almost meet people that through a lifetime have seen that rate of change. Mary grew up with an incredibly traditional lifestyle, sleeping in skin tents, nomadic, following the animals, was then taken away and sent to a Catholic nunnery, taken away from her parents and raised in a nunnery, had an organized marriage and is now keeping up to date with her great-grandchildren on her iPhone, and still goes to fish camp every year, even though she's not allowed to fish anymore, still has this kind of ritual of going and making camp and just sitting on the banks and kind of watching the fish go past now. So both the beauty of the Alaskan history, but also the real darkness, the legacy of the religious boarding schools and the way that people had their culture forced out of them and were forced to speak English and were beaten for speaking their native languages, and the sexual abuse and everything else is wrapped up in her story.
It's a fascinating tale, and as you say, it gives us a real insight into the people. And I love the way you sort of, you juxtapose the life of the fish with the life of the people.
Yeah, there's something in the Mary chapter, because salmon have this incredible life cycle where in the last few months of their lives, they'll be heading upriver, aiming for the exact same spawning grounds where they were born to spawn. And then once they've spawned, they'll almost just kind of start to rot whilst they're still alive. They're so fundamentally exhausted that they're no longer resistant to fungal infections or anything like that. And there seemed a connection there between Mary, who had had her 12 kids and was now kind of questioning what she was still doing at fish camp, and seeing the whole kind of beautiful scope of her life. There's just a real sense of both, I suppose, the salmon and the people there, of that kind of sacrifice for future generations, something that I feel that we in the West could probably try and learn something from.
And you do give us some fantastic facts. There's one about salmon that I really loved, about distinguishing a single drop of water from their birthing location.
By smell. So it's now thought that the main way that salmon are able to home in on their spawning grounds is through their sense of smell. So from 2,000 miles away, they'll be able to detect this kind of chemical map of the minerals that will lead them on this kind of breadcrumb trail back up to where they were born. It's absolutely astonishing, something that, you know, we had maps and GPS and compasses and sat phones and everything, and we were going downriver with the current. They're going upriver against it with only their senses to guide them.
Well, maybe
to somewhere that they've only ever been once in their life before, when they were smolts.
Maybe homeopathy works then. Extraordinary, an extraordinary thing. I wonder how it changed you.
We live on a boat in London. So although we've come back to, you know, a city of 7 million people, we're lucky enough to live on the River Lee and be in quite an isolated part of London. And I do like being able to sort of bridge those two worlds. I think in some ways it showed me that whilst I'd had this huge fantasy about this wilderness and that I needed to go and kind of find myself there in some way, it's a place with its own problems as much as anywhere else's. And I feel like these trips are really important, but it's also really important to kind of learn to live where you are and sort of dig where you stand as well.
Mm. And the trips are really important in the work it produces, because, of course, at the heart of it, there is a very, very strong environmental message.
Yeah, I think that's undeniable. I think something that I've maybe felt from my kind of environmental activism days is that I hope that perhaps that message is better got across, not by kind of shoving it down people's throats, but trying to couch it in a story that's about people and about landscape and about travel and about adventure. And, you know, you can't look at Alaska without talking about climate change, but maybe it's easier to sort of get in under the skin if you frame it as an adventure story.
Mm. So what's the future for the king salmon?
Well, it's an interesting time to write about it. I am sort of used as an environmental journalist to going and writing about places that seem almost hopeless. And the salmon doesn't seem that. The salmon feels kind of poised at the moment between a total crash that it would never come back from, but there's the potential there for trying to restore it. And that potential comes from dialogue. And if certain measures are taken and we can remember what we're trying to achieve, I think it is possible. The challenge comes from how do you also retain people's right to fish? How are the cultures able to carry on practicing the sorts of culture that they want to practice? How do you allow First Nations people to go out and catch the fish that's so important to their cultural identity, but also allow the salmon to thrive?
And can that cultural identity survive in a place of such clash, where there are these old ways, but as you say, they're on iPhones too?
I think it can. I felt a real sense of pride being there. So parts of the Yukon in these villages, the population is increasing. And although a lot of people will leave for the big cities and never come back, there is a real pride in the culture. No one's saying that we're, you know, this idea of sort of a romantic past and wanting to go back to everyone living in tents and suffering from diseases and all the rest of it. But I got a sense that people would like to be able to decide what their future looks like on their own terms. Of course, they're 21st century Americans, but they are also Yupik or Athabascans. And it's things like these crashes in animal numbers, it's things like climate change that are sort of taking away the right for them to decide.
Finally, Adam, the book is dedicated to both your, as that point, unborn child and to your parents, which really sort of sums it up in a way.
Yeah, I think beyond anything, what these cultures really stand for is remembering their pasts and looking to their futures. This idea of thinking about the seven generations before and the seven generations that come after. And there's a metaphor for the salmon there as well. And it felt important to me as part of the book to both honour sort of where I'd come from and where I'm going.
And it's beautifully, beautifully written, as agreed by the judges of the Sunday Times Young Writers Award.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in, Adam. That's Adam Weymouth. His debut book, The Kings of the Yukon, An Alaskan River Journey, is published by Penguin. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.